Hi, I'm Bob DeWay from Gospel of Grace Fellowship. The following is part one of a message I preached some years ago about the shocking truth that Jesus must suffer and die a horrible, shameful death on a cross. Jesus predicts not only his death, but his resurrection. Furthermore, we need to learn the true meaning of the cross. Let's listen.
Chapter 9 of Luke, and we have a very, very central, important passage in Luke here because it has to do with Christ as the Messiah. It has to do with the cross. It has to do with discipleship, and it has to do with the cost of discipleship and the important decision that we have to make about willingness to follow Jesus Christ according to the terms of the gospel. In Luke 9, now, we are tying together some of the narrative threads from earlier from the Galilean ministry, because those were leading us somewhere. Those threads were leading us to Christ's identity. Who is Jesus Christ? And then it's creating new narrative threads that will carry on all the way into Acts, because now we're going to start talking about the cross, and Jesus is a Messiah who's going to die. And later in chapter 9 of Luke, Jesus begins his journey toward Jerusalem, and that is what the whole rest of Luke is about, going to Jerusalem to die. So we're at a pivotal part of our narrative. Let me first give you a summary that I showed you this last week that shows what Luke is doing and how he's telling the story about Jesus. People are asking questions and statements are being made to help us know who Jesus is. That's the key issue. Who is this Jesus Christ? And notice these questions in Luke 3:22, 4:22, and so on this slide that I showed you last week. And then looking again at Luke 9, you'll see that we have Jesus' identity. Who is this man? Herod asks. Who do the multitudes say I am? In our passage we're going to look at today, who do you say that I am? Things are being stated. The Son of Man must suffer. That seems like an incongruity to them. This is my son. That's on the Mount of Transfiguration. Listen to him. There's some allusions to the Old Testament when we get that far, we'll be talking about. Then there's the idea of the Son of Man. Here's this Son of Man who is going to, according to Daniel, have dominion and authority. But here it says, this Son of Man is delivered into the hands of men. It seems like, again, a huge incongruity to the Jewish people who had the prophecies of the Old Testament. And then it says that they did not understand. So we have this issue of Jesus' identity being revealed and people not fully understanding it. And this doesn't get resolved until later in the very end of Luke and the beginning of Acts. Now let's begin with Luke 9 and verse 18. That's our section. And it happened that while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, who do the people say that I am? Now remember earlier in this chapter, Herod asked about who he was. Now Jesus asked the disciples, who the people? The word multitudes or people there, akloi in Greek, could mean the crowd. Sometimes it's used, for example, in the Gospel of John, the same Greek word is used with kind of the connotation of the uneducated masses, because the Pharisees said, well, the akloi, the crowd, they don't know anything. And if you were studying with us in John on Thursday night, remember we talked about that passage. And so Jesus in Luke prays before there's something very important that's going to happen. He goes off to pray, and then we have immediately following his praying a very important part that brings forward the narrative and reveals more about who Jesus is and what he does. Now let's go to verse 19. In response to the question, who do the crowd say that I am? The disciples answered. They answered and said, John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, but others that one of the prophets of old has risen again. So the consensus of the crowd was that Jesus was a prophet, because John the Baptist had already been announced as a great prophet. Elijah, we know, was a great prophet in Israel's history, or one of the prophets. So they know that much. Having seen the miracles, having heard his teachings in Galilee, and the mighty deeds of Jesus, they at least came to the conclusion he's a prophet. Now, we know that that is correct, but it's less than the full answer. He's more than a prophet, but he is a prophet. Because, as a matter of fact, Jesus is the prophet who was predicted by Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 18. Remember, Moses said that God would raise up a prophet like Moses, and that when God did do that, the people should listen to him, right? They should listen to him. So here in Luke 9, it's saying that he's a prophet, and not too far further into this story, further than we're going to get today, but on the Mount of Transfiguration, God says, listen to him. So he's identified as the prophet predicted by Moses. But as we shall see, there's more to his identity, and this needs to be known. Now, interestingly, Herod had asked about his identity, and he knew what the public opinion was, but he rejected that, but he remained perplexed about who Jesus really was. The disciples know public opinion, and they also don't say the same thing, because look at what they say now in verse 20. And he said to them, but who do you? This is emphatic and plural, okay? The you is emphatic and plural. Who do you say that I am? And Peter answered, now because of the plural you, he's answering for the group. Peter answered and said, the Christ of God. I believe there's an implication that this may be a result of Jesus' prayer. He prayed, and then Peter, understanding, moves forward. It moves forward beyond what the crowd understood, beyond what had been revealed so far. And this is a great and true answer. This means the Messiah. The term Christ means Messiah. Christos in the Greek means anointed one. And Peter is identifying Jesus as the promised Messiah that God had said that he would send to Israel. The construction in the Greek, the genitive here, I believe is subjective. And so that would mean that he is promised by God. He is sent by God. He's the Christ whom God sent. By implication here, this is a great statement. It's a true statement. But as we will see later in Luke chapter 9, they still don't fully understand what that means, because there is an entirely different conception about who the Messiah is than what Jesus is about to reveal about himself. So Peter says, you are the Christ, the Messiah. And then shortly thereafter, as we will see, Jesus says that he must suffer and die and be rejected by the Sanhedrin. And this is absolutely shocking. In fact, in the Matthew account, Peter rebukes him for saying that. Because in their idea, the Messiah is the one who's going to come and deliver Israel. First of all, I want to have a slide of some affirmations. Look at how Luke has been helping us to know what we're supposed to know about Christ. These were already stated up to the one that we have here in Luke 9:20. In Luke 2:11, an angel says, who is Christ the Lord? An angel declares the one to be born to be the Messiah, the promised one, the anointed one. Simeon, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, had been told that he wouldn't die until he saw the Lord's Christ. The Lord's Christ. In Luke 4:18, Jesus cited Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, in his hometown of Nazareth. And that passage is a messianic one about the Lord has anointed me to bring a deliverance or release to captives. It's a thematic statement, a programmatic statement in Luke 4:18. Very, very important statement. And Jesus said, today, this Scripture is fulfilled. So Jesus there declared himself to be the Christ. And then Luke 4:41, the demons knew him to be the Christ. And now the disciples know Jesus to be the Christ, the anointed one, the promised Messiah, about whom the Bible had predicted and spoken. So let's move now forward to Luke 9 and verse 21. And here's what it says. But he warned them and instructed them not to tell this to anyone. Now this may seem very puzzling, because as we've been reading Luke and learning from Luke, this revelation that he's the Messiah is going forward, as I just showed you with that slide, going forward from the angels to Simeon to God declaring him to be the Messiah, to Jesus declaring himself to be the Messiah, to be the true Christ. And now that they finally understand it, as Peter has declared him to be the Messiah, the Christ, he warns them not to tell anyone. Now, why would he do this? Why would he say, don't tell anyone, now that they finally know what the truth is? Well, there's a reason for that, because the next statement is going to show us that his understanding of what the Messiah does is totally different than what their expectations were. For Jesus to be the Messiah meant suffering, rejection, and death. For the people, being Messiah meant freedom from Rome, victory over Israel's enemies, a great national kingdom for Israel with the Son of David seated on the throne as promised in the Old Testament. And so if they proclaim this is the Messiah now, given the expectations of the people, it'll create a premature conflict with Rome and with the leaders. The time for Jesus to be rejected is future, not right now. There's a long road to Jerusalem, and it goes from Luke 9 all the way toward the end of Luke to the point of the kingly entry, as we call it, the royal entry into Jerusalem. So there's a long road and a lot of teaching to do before the people are going to have their popular misconception dashed. Proclamation now would actually create a confrontation with Rome and with the Jewish leadership. And there's already the confrontation is boiling and coming to a head, and it's going to get even worse. Even the disciples do not understand that Messiah must suffer. So they can't have a time of proclamation until after the cross. And in Luke, it happens later in Acts 2 when the proclamation of Messiahship is made to all the people, because then finally Peter and the disciples fully understand, or actually they don't fully understand, they understand better, because Peter has to still find out that it includes Gentiles. And that doesn't happen until Acts chapter 10. So this whole idea of messianic identity is being unfolded as we're reading Luke Acts. And Luke is crafting under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit a beautiful telling of the story of the Messiahship of Jesus of Nazareth, who he is, what he did, and why we need him. Now let's get to the key statement here in Luke 9:22. This statement, dear ones, we must realize that at the time that it's made, it is exceedingly shocking. In fact, it's going to get more shocking when we get to the next verse. But this is shocking to the people. This is fully outside of their popular ideas about the Son of Man. It says here, saying the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and raised up on the third day. Now, let this sink in. The Son of Man is an allusion to Daniel chapter 7. The Son of Man is the one who has dominion. It's the one to whom all the people give obedience. And he shall be this sovereign, reigning Son of Man in glory. So saying Son of Man and alluding to Daniel, and then saying he must be rejected by his own people. How is he going to have dominion over all if he's rejected by his own people? And the people, the elders, chief priests, and scribes would roughly constitute the Sanhedrin, the great ruling body in Jewish leadership. This is a shocking revelation of the true nature of what it means to be the Messiah, is to be killed. Now, it says here the Son of Man must. Now, this is a very strong word in the Greek, day. It's been used before by Luke, and it means it's a necessity. It means that this must, this necessity, is due to God's eternal purposes. Jesus must be rejected because it was the eternal purpose of God that the Messiah that he promised would come and be killed in the manner that he was and raised in the third day. And so this must indicates to us that this is not some tragic U-turn. This is not some tragic interruption of a plan that God wanted to do but was unable to do. But this is according to what God intended from the beginning. Now, this divine necessity, day, in the Greek, the idea that this is the plan of God is going to be reaffirmed by Luke through the mouth of Peter, who spoke it on the day of Pentecost in Acts 2, 22 and 23, that this was the foreordained plan of God. Notice that he's being rejected. The word in the Greek for rejected, apodokimazo, and that word we've seen before, and it means to put something to the test, and then it's strengthened by the prefix. So it means that they're going to examine Jesus, they're going to put him to the test, and they are going to stand in judgment and say, we've examined this one, and we reject him. This isn't just an accidental idea, but it's a purposeful one that happens after some testing that they put him to. So obviously, they're not understanding God's purpose. Now, notice, though, that here, at this crucial point in the narrative, Jesus is predicting his own resurrection from the dead. This becomes a very, very important thing for us to realize that this happened, because this is one of the strongest points, apologetically, that we have as Christians in our proclamation of the gospel. Jesus predicting his own resurrection from the dead and then actually being raised before credible witnesses and many witnesses makes this an absolute unique event in all of history. Never before or after has a man predicted his own resurrection from the dead, specifically when it would happen and how it would happen, and then accomplished it and appears to witnesses. And in fact, one of the things everyone agreed about in the book of Acts, even the hostile witnesses, was that the grave was empty. Nobody ever claimed that they had a grave that had Jesus' body in it identified. The only issue was what happened to the body. And the witnesses that knew saw him, and he appeared to many, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. So this is extremely important that he's predicting this. Let's keep it in mind as we study Luke Acts. Now, the shocking event here becomes even more shocking, and I'm going to try my best today to show you how shocking this was. I don't think we understand it as Christians. I know that my understanding has grown in the last week because of the research that I've done. And the reason we don't understand it is that we don't see the cross as a negative thing. Okay? Most Christians cherish the idea of the cross. And there's reason for that. I'm not being critical, but I'm telling you it's not helping us understand now. I want you to know something. Not once in the entire Bible, when the word cross is mentioned, does it refer to a Christian symbol. There is no such thing. Now, I'm not here arguing for or against symbols. All right? Some people like a lot of symbols, and some people are against them. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just informing you of something I don't think people know. In fact, some very, very bright people make a mistake on this point. In fact, I was reading someone's article, a friend of mine who I admire, And he was rebuking the church for taking the cross out of the church. And what he meant was the object, the icon, or symbol. That's what that word means. And so I wrote him a letter, and I said, you're making a category error. The term cross is never referring to a symbol, not once in the entire Bible. All right, that happened later in church history. So whether the symbol is in the church or not in the church isn't an issue. What's at issue is whether the cross is preached in the church. When the Bible talks about the cross, it either means the literal cross that Jesus actually died on, or it means the message that's based on that, because Paul uses the term cross to mean the message of the saving work of Christ. So why am I telling us this? Because I want us to get our minds back into the Jewish first century. And I'm going to read you some material from Josephus to help that happen. And I want you to realize that the idea of the cross was the most loathsome, abhorrent, and offensive thing that could exist in Israel. And I'm going to show you why it was that way. And I'm going to show you that when Jesus required cross-bearing as terms of discipleship, this is absolutely shocking. It is so horrifically shocking that it's hard to believe. Remember the book? That book by John MacArthur, Hard to Believe, was inspired by this passage and others like it. This is so shocking, it's literally hard to believe. Let me read it to you. And he was saying to them all, now this is broad, this is a general call to whoever is listening to him. He was saying to them all, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake, he is the one who will save it. Now, I am going to do my absolute best by God's grace to unpack this, and I hope that before we're done this morning, everyone here will totally understand it in a way that maybe you haven't before. Now, the term wishes in the Greek is thelo, and it's the term for will or purpose. So this isn't talking about just some human desire. It's not talking about that at all. It says, if anyone makes it his purpose, his willful choice, his purpose to be my disciple, then he must deny himself and take up his cross. Now I'm going to unpack this a little bit now. Then we're going to go to the cross in Jewish history, and then we're going to come back to this again. But just let you know what this is saying. The term for deny here means to reject, to repudiate, and to disavow. In other words, in order to be a disciple of Jesus Christ, you have to look at your own life as something so loathsome, you disavow it. This is the same thing that what Peter did when he denied Christ. You're one of his, aren't you? No. He disowned him. He disavowed him. That's what we got to do to ourselves. Now, what does that have to do with cross-bearing? The only person that would be carrying a cross in first century Judea was someone who had been sentenced to death and given the cross, the beam, not the entire cross. Now, I did a lot of research on this week from many sources, and it's agreed by the scholars and the people that know the history of the first century that the vertical beams were already planted in the ground and just left there for the sake of efficiency, because the Romans crucified a lot of people different times. And the thing that was carried by the condemned criminal was the cross beam. That's what the research indicates. All right? So carrying this cross beam, if you saw someone doing that, they'd already been beaten, so their backs would be shredded. They attached things to the end of the lashes to rip up the skin. So the backs of the persons would be shredded, and they would be carrying this. And everybody seeing that poor soul would know that the only thing that was left of that person was to die. They had no hopes, no dreams. They weren't putting anything away for their retirement. Okay? They were on their way to die. How often did this happen? Well, let's have a little history lesson here. I brought with me, I have Josephus as part of my Logos Bible software, and I do not get a cut for saying that, but it sure is handy. Josephus lists before this, I'm just going back before, let's say 30 AD or whenever this was, before 30 AD, Jesus is making his statement. And I'm only going back before that. It happened after. But before that, the first mention was Antiochus Epiphanes. Remember him? Antiochus Epiphanes, the almost Antichrist, the guy who desecrated the temple, the guy who was an evil conqueror. And here's what Josephus said. And indeed, many Jews there were who complied with the king's command, either voluntarily or out of fear of the penalty that it was denounced, but the best men, those of the noblest souls, did not regard him. In other words, they didn't listen to this Antiochus, but did pay a greater respect to the customs of their country than concern as to the punishment which he threatened to the disobedient, on which account they every day underwent great miseries and bitter torments, for they were whipped with rods, and their bodies were torn to pieces, and were crucified while they were still alive and breathed. So they were beaten and then crucified. And they strangled those women and their sons whom they had circumcised, and as the king had appointed, hanging their sons about the necks as they were on crosses. So they crucified some alive, and some they killed them and hung them on crosses, and probably just like a V-shaped thing, and they're hung by their head, dead. Why? Because this was abhorrent to the Jews. Cursed is every man who hangs on a tree. In a Jewish thinking, in their way of understanding, it was very, very important what happened after you died and what happened to the body. That's why they didn't like to go to sea, because they did not want to risk dying at sea and not having a proper burial. And so in order to torment the Jews, their conquerors would desecrate the bodies of those that they tortured and killed, and putting them on a cross was a way not only to die a death of shame, but to be desecrated after you were dead. And the Jews, if they possibly could, wanted to get the bodies off of the cross before the sun went down to give them a proper burial. And if the Romans were really wanting to torment them, they would not allow that to happen. In fact, it would leave the bodies until jackals or vultures would eat the body, thus creating fear and torment and sorrow and misery in the minds of every Jewish person. Now that was back at 167 BC. Now let's go forward to 88 BC. And there arose, ironically, a Jewish person, although he took a Greek name. He was one of the Hasmonean kings and one of the descendants of the time of the Maccabees, who was on the throne. And here's what Josephus says about this guy, Alexander Janus, 88 BC. Now, as Alexander fled to the mountains, 6,000 of the Jews hereupon came together to him out of pity. In other words, they had rose up against him and made a deal with the Seleucids because he was such a tyrant, and so his own Jewish people rebelled against him. But then they had pity on him when they saw that he was going to lose because he was one of theirs, and upon which Demetrius was afraid and retired out of the country, after which the Jews fought against Alexander, and being beaten, were slain in great numbers in the several battles which they had. And when he had shut up the most powerful of them, that is the Jews, in the city of Bethom, he besieged them therein. And when he had taken the city and gotten the men into his power, he brought them to Jerusalem and did one of the most barbarous actions in the world to them. For as he was feasting with his concubines in the sight of all the city, he ordered about 800 of Jewish, these are Jewish men, 800 of them to be crucified. And while they were living, they're dying on the cross, but still alive, while they were living, he ordered the throats of their children and wives to be cut before their eyes. He killed and slaughtered their children while these Jewish men are dying on the cross. This is a heinous, wicked evil associated with crosses, and it was done by a Jewish tyrant, Alexander Janus. I'm fast forwarding now to 4 BC. Here's what it says. This is about a man by the name of Quintilius Varus, who was a Roman general. Here's what Josephus says about this. But Varus sent a part of his army into the country against those who had been the authors of this commotion. They'd had a rebellion. And as they caught great numbers of them, those that appeared to have been the least concerned in these tumults, he put into custody. But such as were the most guilty, he crucified. These in number about 2,000. Quintilius Varus had crucified 2,000 Jews publicly. Now, this was always done around the roads and places where people came. Remember when Jesus was crucified, they had, "This is the King of the Jews," so people would come by and see it and read it. The Romans did this to strike fear into the hearts of people who might ever get an idea of doing any kind of rebellion against Rome, because they feared this crucifixion more than anything else, and it was a horrible, tormenting death. 2,000 of them hung on crosses for hours and hours in Judea, all about the roads. 4 B.C. Now, whenever Jesus was speaking, 4 B.C. wasn't that many years before. So therefore, remember where they're condemned, they had to carry the crossbeam. 2,000 men beaten. 2,000 men carrying a crossbeam. 2,000 men dying a slow, painful, torturous death at the hands of Israel's enemies in order to put them down, put them in their place, torment them, scare them, demoralize them, and outrage them, and anything they could do to them. And I'm telling you that the audience that heard Jesus say that you had to carry a cross to be a disciple had seen their fathers, their uncles, and their grandparents possibly crucified. Anybody that was related to one of those 2,000 men had lost a family member to this outrageous act of barbarism.
Please tune in next week for part two of this message.
Both want to remind you out there that you can access this program at our website at cicministry.org. It says in Philippians 1:27 to stand firm in one spirit with one mind and strive together for the faith of the gospel.